Renewable energy is big business in Spain and Portugal. That industry is holding up even in the midst of this global recession, which has slammed the economies of both countries. The Iberian Peninsula has little in the way of fossil fuel, but plenty of sun and wind, and both Spain and Portugal have invested heavily in alternative energy over the last few years. They are now home to some of the biggest renewable energy companies in the world. Jerome Sokolowski begins this report at a project that harnesses the power of waves in Portugal.
On the beach in the northern Portuguese town of Aguça da Oura, there are a couple of fishermen sitting next to their rods and a surfer waiting for the perfect wave. Out to sea, there's a thin orange line just below the horizon. That's the palamis, an undulating steel snake that draws energy from the ocean.
You can see it flexing in the waves now, or you certainly see it, parts of it disappearing as the waves go by.
Martin Shaw is an engineer with Palamis Wave Power, a Scottish firm that designed the 460-foot-long steel snake that generates electricity from wave motion. Palamis is an ancient Greek word for water snake. Three of these modern metal snakes went online last September as the world's first commercial wave farm.
So it's generating at the moment in these waves and sending the power back to the substation.
Right now, the wave farm provides electricity to about 1,000 homes in Portugal. The plan is to enlarge it until it produces as much as a typical nuclear or coal-fired power plant. So why did a company from Scotland, one of the windiest places in Europe, set up its first commercial wave project in Portugal? The answer, says Shaw, is subsidies.
The first farm has arrived here in Portugal because the feed-in tariff, at least a viable level, was set here before anywhere else, and that really made it economically viable.
The feed-in tariff is an artificially high price that the Portuguese government has set to encourage the generation of electricity by wave power. Public financing has fueled a boom in renewable energy in both Portugal and Spain. It's turned Iberian power companies like EDP, which operates the wave farm, into global giants of the renewable energy industry. On a bluff above the town of Astudillo in northern Spain, 211 wind turbines turn slowly in the breeze. It's one of many wind farms in Spain operated by Iberdrola, the world's largest wind energy producer. Like EDP in Portugal, Spain's Iberdrola is making a big push in North America. Both companies have dozens of wind farms in the U.S., and they're spending billions of dollars to buy more. Here in Spain, the government is also encouraging solar energy. Every new home must have solar panels installed on the roof. But Fernando Martinez Riaza of Iberdrola says wind power already supplies up to a third of the nation's electricity needs. I think wind energy has a bright future despite the economic difficulties we're having now, he says. In fact, the Spanish government sees renewable energy as part of the solution to the country's economic problems. Juan Carlos Martinez Lázaro is an economics professor at Madrid's IE Business School. Even in times of crisis, investment in renewable energy shouldn't be reduced, he says. On the contrary, it should be increased. He says the renewable energy industry brings jobs to rural areas and helps reduce the national trade deficit, which is largely caused by oil imports. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Astudillo, Spain.
Batteries for laptop computers are getting better. Next month, computer maker Hewlett-Packard will offer batteries that may, they say, outlast the laptop itself. They're made by a company called Boston Power. It's the first U.S. company to break into a market dominated by the Japanese. From member station WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
At the laboratory of Boston Power, CEO Christina Lampa Enrud checks a testing station full of the cells that go into her company's batteries. Each is being spent and then recharged over and over.
We're now testing cells that are still going strong at 1,400 cycles at perfect condition.
Most conventional batteries peter out after just a few hundred charges. Lampa Enrud says they start out strong.
But then they only hold that for a few charges, and then they start fading. So what really did you buy?
Since Boston Power's batteries hold their juice longer, they don't have to be replaced as often. She says that reduces the environmental impact. Next month, HP will start shipping these batteries as an optional upgrade on new laptops, costing up to $30 more. Forrester research analyst Chris Mines says that premium will be hard for most people to buy into.
Consumers don't think about lifetime cost of ownership. They think about sticker price.
Still, Mines expects the number of green-minded battery buyers to amp up with time, the same way more car buyers nowadays are willing to fork over for hybrids. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nikisch in Boston.
President-elect Barack Obama has been busy filling remaining cabinet posts this week. He picked a former governor of Iowa to lead the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Obama touted Tom Vilsack's credentials at a press conference yesterday.
As governor of one of our most abundant farm states, he led with vision, promoting biotech to strengthen our farmers and fostering an agricultural economy of the future that not only grows the food we eat, but the energy that we use.
For one view on Mr. Obama's choice, we called Michael Pollan. He's a leader in the sustainable food and agriculture movement, and he recently published an open letter to Mr. Obama suggesting the Department of Agriculture be renamed the Department of Food.
Well, the basic premise of the article was that, you know, you're not going to make progress as a president on climate change, energy independence, or the healthcare crisis unless you address the food system. Because the food system is responsible for about a third of greenhouse gases. It is responsible for the catastrophic American diet that is leading 50% of us to suffer from chronic disease, and that drives up healthcare costs. So I was arguing for, making it a department of food, a secretary of food, and focus more on growing real food, diversifying our farms, relocalizing the food system in order to address all those problems at once.
And back to the choice of Tom Vilsack. From what you know of him, is he a choice for change in the agriculture department and agriculture policy?
Well, I was very disappointed in that news conference not to hear Vilsack use the word food or eaters, and that the interests of everybody except eaters was discussed. Farmers, ranchers, people concerned about the land. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that this is agribusiness as usual. That said, there are reasons to be cautiously hopeful. Vilsack spoke encouragingly about capping subsidies and using that money to drive a conservation agenda. That's great. He's talking about increasing local food production. On the other hand, he presided over the biggest expansion of feedlot agriculture in Iowa. He passed a bill to take away the power of localities to control the siting of those feedlots or regulate them. He also took away the ability of municipalities to deal with biotechnology. So, you know, he's what you'd expect from a governor of Iowa. I'm hoping that now he will take a broader view.
Although talking about making a great transformation in our farming industry, do you think it would be smart, even if it was possible, given that it would drive up the cost of food?
Well, I think the first point you have to keep in mind is what has driven up the cost of food this year. It's the embrace of corn-based ethanol that has driven up all food prices. It's not making agriculture more sustainable. I also think that there is a lot of money to be saved by changing the food system. Obama himself, when asked about how he was going to cut government spending last month, the one example he cited was, our habit of paying huge subsidies to very wealthy farmers. So I think that there's a lot to be saved in agriculture as well. I think if we could back off on ethanol, that will buy us a lot of wiggle room.
Although Tom Vilsack has been a great supporter of biofuels, would you expect that to change?
You know, Obama has been a supporter of corn-based ethanol. Vilsack has been a supporter of corn-based ethanol. I think what's interesting to watch, though, is that the new Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, is a pretty fierce critic of corn-based ethanol. You have a Nobel Prize winner explain to you why it's a bad idea. And I would imagine we'll be arguing for moving away from corn as a feedstock for ethanol toward other crops. And hopefully those crops will not compete with food crops. So the challenge is to move to things like crop waste, trees, grasses that don't compete with food. And whether Vilsack and Obama are ready to go there, it remains to be seen. But certainly Stephen Chu will be pushing them that way.
Michael Pollan is the author of In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
Mr. Obama says America needs to break its addiction to foreign oil and cut the amount of carbon dioxide it produces. One way to do both is to use energy more efficiently. When gas and electricity prices are high, people do use less. But getting people to save energy will require more than just high prices, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Social marketing is a fancy term for persuading people to do the right thing for society. Even government agencies are turning to social marketers to get people to use less energy, regardless of its price. Social marketing worked well for anti-smoking groups. The American Legacy Foundation used scare tactics on smokers in this television spot. It shows a busy city street, lots of speeding cars, and pedestrians getting run over.
Every day, 3,000 Americans start smoking. A third of them will die from it.
But move away from smoking or other harmful habits, and it gets harder to change what people do.
Fear sometimes works, but it doesn't usually work.
Meryl Shugall is president of the marketing firm Shugall Research. She says big oil isn't like big tobacco. After all, people actually need energy, and they don't see it as dangerous. Shugall surveys consumers, and she says many don't know where energy comes from or how using it affects the environment. And when experts try to explain, they can be wonky and confusing.
They throw up their hands. They go, well, today it's a crisis, and tomorrow we don't have to worry about it. And they get mixed signals.
A mixed signal might be debate over how bad global warming could be, or whether ethanol fuel is really better for the environment than gasoline. Shugall says to get people to change their energy habits, you have to tell them how, over and over. One national program that has succeeded in convincing consumers to use less energy is the Environmental Protection Agency's Energy Star program. It certifies and labels the most efficient appliances, refrigerators, dishwashers, even whole houses. But it does more than that. Maria Vargas is an Energy Star director. She says information on kilowatt hours isn't quite enough to get consumers to commit.
People buy on emotion and they justify with the facts. And for a while, we were just so fact-driven, and I think we realized fairly early on that there has to be more to it than that.
To reach the heart, the Energy Star program also tells people their decisions can help protect the planet from environmental damage. But, Vargas adds, consumers also want to see some pocketbook advantages. I put that theory to the test at Appliance Land in Annapolis, Maryland, where store manager Jerry Walker roams down aisles of shiny new refrigerators.
If you compare this one, this is a non-Energy Star unit, so you're using about 479 kilowatts at about $51 a year, estimated.
$51 to operate a refrigerator per year.
Non-Energy Star.
Walker eventually finds an Energy Star refrigerator. It's bigger than the first one, and it runs cheaper.
It's 3 cubic foot larger capacity, but you can see there's a difference of about $8 over the course of a year.
And that really makes a difference to people.
It does. It really does.
And here's something else consumers want, to feel like they're intelligent. The group Alliance to Save Energy is trying to help consumers drive smarter. The Alliance's Roseanne Weissman says consumers told her they wanted tips on how to do that.
People wanted to be smart about their choices. They wanted to know more, and they wanted dollar signs attached to the tips so that they could make a determination for their own bottom line.
So that's how the Alliance designed this radio spot for their recent Drive Smarter Challenge campaign.
My baby's talking?
And what I want to talk about is your driving. Your jackrabbit starts are wasting gas.
He's backseat driving.
He's up on the highway, too. Every 10 miles per hour you go over 60, it's like paying 40 cents more a gallon. Ma, it's time for a change.
I'll drive smarter.
So, being smart, saving money, and helping the environment. And then, of course, you can always try to shame people into doing the right thing. Social marketer Meryl Shugall recalls one way recycling caught on.
What happened is your kids would come home from school and they learned about it in their science class and they would reprimand you.
There is one thing that social marketers are not likely to ask people to do, though. Sacrifice. Former President Jimmy Carter tried that. He put on a sweater and told Americans to lower the thermostat. It didn't work. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We've got an example of social marketing that's funny from the Energy Star campaign at our website, npr.org.
Plummeting gas and diesel prices have given consumers relief at the pump, but for how long? Oil pessimists believe the current slump in demand will pass, but the world remains in the same fix it was before the global recession. The era of easy oil is behind us. They say world oil production has already peaked, and that will inevitably change the way we live sooner or later. NPR's John Burnett reports on what's called peak oil theory and how some people are already preparing for it.
Once a month, they gather in a church in central Austin to discuss how to survive the end of oil. The group calls itself Crude Awakening. They say never mind that gasoline is the cheapest it's been in 4 years. When the economic crisis abates, demand for oil will rebound and prices will jump back up. And when that happens, the group will become relevant again, says Brian McNerney, a 46-year-old retired Army lieutenant colonel.
Now, when gas prices peaked here about 6 months ago, 4 months ago, we had our largest meeting, I guess, probably in July. We had about 20, 25.
On this night, about a dozen people have showed up. What this group does, and dozens like it around the United States and the globe, is to trade lifestyle tips on how to kick our oil addiction.
My name is Paul Carrigas, and I'm 44 years old. I work in the semiconductor industry. I've been aware of peak oil for about 3 years now. And since then, personally, I changed my life. I got rid of my cars. I get around by bicycle 90% of the time.
They discuss bicycle maintenance, the best hybrids to drive, gardening, shopping locally, installing solar panels. They've all had, well, a crude awakening, as recounted here by Greg Bausner, a 37-year-old network administrator.
Oh, my God. I think it's oil that's really going to be the first thing that smacks us in the face and forces us to confront the fact that we cannot live this way any longer, that this is not sustainable.
On this night in early November, there's big news. The usually staid International Energy Agency in Paris issued an alarming report that concluded what's needed is nothing short of an energy revolution, a rapid move toward low-carbon societies. The speaker tonight is Michael Osborne of Austin Energy, the city-owned utility with a national reputation for energy efficiency.
I don't know if y'all read this or not, but first paragraph of the executive summary, the world's energy system is at a crossroads. Current global trends in energy supply and consumption are patently unsustainable, but that can and must be altered.
Oil industry executives don't doubt that world oil production will one day peak. The debate is over when. The orthodoxy set forth by most major oil companies, OPEC, and the U.S. Energy Information Administration is that the inevitable plateau is still decades away, probably past the middle of this century. And by then, we'll have even more renewable energy sources in place and even better technology to extract hard-to-get reserves. So their message is, don't panic. Peter Jackson is the senior oil industry analyst at the influential Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He's the author of a 2006 report, Why the Peak Oil Theory Falls Down.
What I have a problem with is that the global production will peak in the very short term, and then the tank will run dry very quickly thereafter. I don't think it's quite as black and white as that. I mean, clearly we're dealing with a finite resource, but we see strong growth in oil supply unfolding in the next few years, and there is a strong inventory of new projects of oil already discovered.
Jackson points to major new deepwater projects in Brazil, Angola, and Nigeria, and the expectation of plentiful non-conventional oil from Canada and Venezuela. His optimism is in contrast to the dire predictions of peak oil's foremost prophet, Matt Simmons.
I am saying the sky's falling. If we ignore peak oil, even worse if we laugh about it, and we just continue consuming, we will have a massive shortage.
The garrulous 65-year-old oilfield investment banker from Houston says what's more important is the fact that the world's giant oil fields are all in decline, from the North Sea to Mexico's Cantarell Field. He gave a speech earlier this fall at a posh Houston hotel before a group called the Young Professionals in Energy.
Energy reality, if you take off rose-colored glasses and just study data, is that crude oil in most non-OPEC countries is now in decline, and in too many countries in steep decline. Virtually all of the OPEC producers, with the exception of Angola, are really struggling to keep their production flat.
The fresh-faced group listening to him intently comprises the next generation of energy industry leaders. I decided to take a quick poll to see what they thought of his gloomy speech. In order are Matt Boyd, a geologist, Mike Cox, an oil services consultant, and Andrew Keene, an energy lender.
People don't understand how serious the problem is. Like he pointed out, the declines in Mexico are huge. The declines in Venezuela are huge.
I think he's a little bit on the aggressive side in believing that we've already peaked, but I do agree that we've got that on the horizon, and there's not an infinite amount of oil, and at some point we're going to have to deal with the declining curve.
I think the world's definitely running out of oil. I don't think that the predictions that Saudi Arabia can replace 15 to 35 million barrels a day is feasible, and we need to consider some alternatives and some other options.
So it turns out maybe the next generation of oil and gas executives is not as sanguine about the future of oil as the current industry leadership. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
Now to Mr. Obama's nominees for key energy and environmental posts, which signal his interest in promoting renewable energy and tackling climate change. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has this story.
Mr. Obama's choices won't have to do a lot of homework before they get started. Carol Browner, Stephen Chu, and Lisa Jackson are experts with many years of experience as government managers.
This is a team that can hit the ground running.
Kathleen McGinty headed President Clinton's White House Council on Environmental Quality and until recently ran Pennsylvania's Environment Agency.
I think it is a team that will have the combined smarts on the substantive side of these issues as well as the political acumen and strategy and ability to bring the right players to the table.
After 8 years of complaining about the Bush administration's failure to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, environmental activists were elated by the announcements.
Many of us who are interested in the climate issue are really heartened by this set of selections because I think it really means that we're going to move forward.
Eileen Clausen heads the Pew Center on Climate Change. She was particularly impressed by Mr. Obama's decision to nominate Stephen Chu as energy secretary.
I think it's absolutely terrific to put someone in at the Department of Energy who is both a scientist and really knowledgeable on energy efficiency and renewables.
Chu is a green energy advocate who heads the Energy Department's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. In an interview with NPR earlier this year, Chu explained why the country has failed to address climate change.
I don't think the American public understands a reasonably high probability some very bad things will happen. They fundamentally don't understand that, because if they really felt that, then they would do something about it.
Industry representatives say they see the appointees as harbingers of change. They expect more regulation and stricter enforcement of environmental laws. Scott Siegel is a lawyer and lobbyist for electricity companies that burn coal.
We're expecting big shifts from where the current administration is to where the next administration will be.
One of the president-elect's goals is to get Congress to adopt a program to slash emissions of greenhouse gases. Lisa Jackson, Mr. Obama's nominee to head the EPA, already helped push a program like that through the New Jersey legislature. Several business representatives who worked with her during that process gave her high marks. David Brogan is a vice president of the New Jersey Business and Industry Association.
It's a very difficult issue. It's a very complex issue. It affects businesses across the spectrum. And she was willing to listen to us, to work with us. She's a good administrator. She understands that you need to hear from all sides before making a final decision.
Jackson has mixed reviews from environmental groups in New Jersey. Some say she hadn't done enough to clean up hazardous waste sites. But others say she has used her considerable political skills and persuasion to promote clean energy and win passage of climate policy. Jackson is a New Orleans native with an academic background in chemical engineering. Her resume includes 16 years working at the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Obama named one of that agency's former chiefs, Carol Browner, to a brand new job as the Climate and Energy Czarina. The president-elect says Browner will coordinate federal, state, and local programs.
She brings the unmatched experience of being a successful and longest-serving administrator of the EPA. She will be indispensable in implementing an ambitious and complex energy policy.
Browner has already started that work in the president-elect's transition team. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.